I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. The book Still Here, The Madcap, Nervy, Singular Life of Elaine Stritch by Alexandra Jacobs is one of the more entertaining books of the last year. She writes of such a fascinating life in the theater that touched the worlds of film, recordings, and television in a long career right up to her Emmy Award-winning guest performances on 30 Rock. Stritch was a captivating performer, whether it was the quips and sass that infused an inflection or performance, or the physical frame of a woman in a shirt and tights, one couldn't help but be drawn in. Ms. Jacobs, who joins me now, investigates the appeal as well as breaks open the challenges that confounded Stritch throughout her life and work, as well as the challenging nature of her outsized personality. She worked with people like Richard Rodgers and George S. Kaufman, Cole Porter, and George Abbott, to Noel Coward, Stephen Sondheim, and Harold Prince, through to James Gandolfini, Tina Fey, Alec Baldwin, and so many others in between. I'll ask Alexandra about writing this book and the uniqueness of its subject. Alexandra Jacobs is an editor and writer at the New York Times. She has written for The New Yorker, The Observer, and Entertainment Weekly. The Twitter handle is at Alexandra Jacobs. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Guru. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Alexandra Jacobs. Ms. Jacobs, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Do you remember when it was, when you first encountered Elaine Stritch? Was it in the theater? Was it on TV? Was it online?
Well, I knew of her in the early 2000s, probably 2000. Actually, it was soon after 9/11 because my cousin, Carrie Feinman, who's a producer, at the time, she was doing press for the Public Theater, and so Elaine Stritch was starring in the show Elaine Stritch at Liberty, and, you know, it was, she hadn't really been on, the one way she'd been, she'd infiltrated my consciousness before then was that, you know, we used to go, I worked at a newspaper called the New York Observer at the time, and we used to go to the other Elaine's, not, you know, Kaufman's restaurant, famous restaurant that's cited in the Billy Joel song, and the people that you knew at Elaine's, you know.
Yeah.
So we used to go there, and we would order drinks or whatever, and my colleague would say, I used to like to order a vodka gimlet, and my colleague would joke about it, and he'd say, another vodka stinger, you know. And at the time, I didn't know what he was referring to.
Yeah.
I just thought I was young. I didn't know what he meant. So anyway, fast forward to 2001, the fall, and my boss at that same paper, the New York Observer, was very excited about the show and really wanted to get tickets to it. And it was so that no one could, it was sold out. No one could get a seat. And he was, you know, he had my cousin Carol on the phone, and he was, you know, trying to bother her for Elaine Stritch tickets.
Yeah.
And since this guy and I had a lot in common in terms of our taste, I thought, you know. So and I was so intrigued by her because, you know, she's in her 70s at the time.
Yeah.
And she appeared on stage with no pants. And it was, you know, it just was a very unusual, I couldn't understand sort of why she was such a draw and so important. So that's the first time I really kind of became aware of who she was.
And it's a remarkable life. It's a remarkable career, as you describe in your book, Still Here, because her life intersects with so many people. I mean, you go back to Cole Porter and George Kaufman, through to Sondheim and Prince, and then the way that most people know her today from YouTube, I guess.
That's right.
Gandolfini and Tina Fey, Alec Baldwin.
It's extraordinary.
She's highly regarded, and the thing that I was wondering as I was reading your book was she satisfied with her level of fame, her level of notoriety? I mean, it seems to me that she would have wanted more.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, because I think that all her life, most of her life, she felt underrecognized and cheated. She felt like her talent wasn't getting the recognition it deserved. You know, there are various sort of shadow, not nemeses exactly, but for example, Angela Lansbury crops up in the book as someone that Elaine felt, you know, Angela Lansbury had the career that she really wanted. She got the parts, the range of parts that Elaine really felt she should have had. And you know, other people. But that said, my understanding of it was, you know, she really had a tremendous success with at Liberty. I mean, she was the toast of the town, and she became a celebrity. And then, you know, again, I mean, she had these sort of cycles of like almost making it and having it, you know, and be, you know, there was a time when she was bigger than Sondheim, for example, or uh-huh. there was a time when she was. But so she'd have these ups and downs. After at Liberty, people started stopping her on the street and knowing who she was. And you know, after 30 Rock, forget it. I mean, yeah. But my understanding from speaking to her friends is that really didn't bring her the kind of, you know, sort of core personal satisfaction that she thought it would. And I mean, I think that by the end of her life, she realized that fame was not the thing that would bring her satisfaction. What she really wanted was to do good work. And that's why I found her relationship with Sondheim so intriguing. And it, for me, that was really the heart of the book. And that was sort of what I was pursuing most doggedly the whole time.
Yeah. Did you talk to him at all?
Oh, yeah. He's interviewed. Yeah. He's, I interviewed him early on. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you're doing biography, you want to get to the older people first. Because
right.
You know, you never know what's going to happen.
Sure,
I mean,
yeah.
Thank goodness he's still with us. But several people, including Hal Prince and Liz Smith, I was fortunate enough to interview before they died. But you know, Sondheim was really the one I wanted, and he because I had seen it. So I alluded earlier to that. My first awareness of Elaine, my second awareness of Elaine came when I was I had been assigned to the fashion beat at the New York Times, and I was coming home on an airplane and really upset. Like I really felt like my career had taken a wrong turn, and that I, you know, these fashion shows were very stupid, and that I'd abandoned my artistic roots and my roots in the theater, my roots in music. And I watched the HBO documentary Six by Sondheim.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Saw, yeah, it's a, and there, you know, I saw that I sort of was reminded of the tremendous arc and scope of Sondheim's career. Now Sondheim, I grew up in a family of classical musicians, and I played the viola, and Sondheim was always there in my life. Like, I'm not personally there, but, you know, his
sure,
music
yeah,
was
yeah.
always there. I was conscious of him growing up in New York City in the late 70s and 80s. I was very conscious of Sondheim as, you know, a very, very important composer. But I didn't know Company. I was too young to have seen Company when it came out, and I didn't see its revivals. My parents were more into serious concert music than musicals, although I did see Sunday in the Park with George. Anyway, when I saw
yeah.
this documentary on the plane, there's a clip in the documentary of the D.A. Pennebaker documentary of the cast out, recording the cast out.
Right,
company.
Right.
And, you know, there's a famous scene with Elaine in it that I reconstruct in the book, but there's also just a little clip of her, if I'm recalling correctly, it's the she sings The Little Things You Do Together with you know, with the cast of Company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I saw her, and I recognized, I thought, my God, that's Elaine Stritch. That's the woman who was in at Liberty. And
mm-hmm.
I hadn't put two and two together before. And that was the first time I got the inkling of writing the book.
Yeah.
I thought, she had died recently, my father had also died recently, and I thought, how did that woman get from there to at Liberty? Like, how did
yeah.
she get from being this, and what happened along the way? I mean, that was really the heart of it. And then I started watching that the Pennebaker documentary,
right.
and I got completely fixated.
Yeah. Yeah, so in that documentary, for people listening to us, she's having trouble laying down the record for her big number in the show, The Ladies Who Lunch. And there's a scene there where I guess Tom Shepard is making her listen to the playback, and she's obviously frustrated with the way she sounds. And Sondheim...
And
yeah.
So tipsy, yeah.
And Sondheim is visibly annoyed. And
that's right.
And she's trying to I guess, reassure him, and he's not having it because he's not even looking at her, and it's really painful
That's
to
right.
painful
That's
to
right.
watch. And so
it's painful.
Yeah.
yeah.
And so I'm wondering.
And
yeah.
so you mm-hmm. asked if I'd spoken to him. The answer is yes. At first, you know, we had a phone call.
Yeah.
You know, he gave me a half-hour phone call at first, and I was, you know, I mean, I was. He's a, you know, he's a god of
right,
of
right.
the music,
yeah.
theater and of music in general, and I absolutely adore his music. And think he is the most important, not just of musical theater, but one of the most important composers of the 20th and 21st centuries.
Yeah.
But that first half hour was wonderful. It was very concentrated, very honest assessment, articulate assessment of Elaine. However, I was determined, I really wanted to meet him in person because I really felt there was more. I booked him at the very beginning of my research, and I felt, I uncovered so much more during the research of the book that I then wanted to go back to him. And so I finally did have occasion to interview him in person after the gender-reversed
production company
yeah. came out, yes, mm-hmm. which is coming to Broadway. And so, that was a tremendous opportunity. It really felt like kismet because, as readers of the book will find out, the most exciting part of my research was to discover that Elaine had informed the writing of Company much more than is acknowledged or discussed. Like, she had actually been part of its conception. Not just, her character, Joanne, which everyone acknowledges was based on her and written for her, and that Sondheim wrote it for her in 1899.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just that, but the idea of Bobby, the protagonist. Mm-hmm. Because Bobby's a single person, and he's wrestling with commitment, and that is something Elaine also wrestled with her entire life. Just the idea of living alone versus being with someone.
So I'm reading your book, and I'm wondering, because she obviously thought he was Sondheim was a tremendous talent and someone that she liked. I'm wondering, did he like her?
That's such a good question. He really, I found out so much about that, and I still don't feel like I have an adequate answer to that question. I mean, I think their friendship, their relationship was very complicated. He told me it wasn't so complicated. He basically said that they had more of a public friendship and that, people, I think he is very conscious of people misconstruing their relationship,
yeah.
which, is so easy to do when you're talking about two famous skilled people that you see represented in musicals or documentaries or whatever. Like, I get that. I mean, it sounds to me like people, and also I bet my feeling is a lot of people would say, when she died or whatever, they'd say, Elaine Stritch, the foremost arbiter, foremost interpreter of Stephen Sondheim. If I were Stephen Sondheim, that would make me pretty annoyed because you think about the range of music he's written. In fact, as a composer, what he composed for Elaine was pretty narrow, and his assessment of her as a singer in the book, it's not unkind, but it's very accurately, she's a certain kind of singer. She's a, I think, Sprechsung, or I'm going to mispronounce, there's a German word for it. It's like it's a kind of sort of nightclubby, smoky, chanteuse speak singing, which incorporates the personality of Elaine. She's always, when she's singing, she's not like, it's not like a Barbara Cook thing where she's really giving herself over to the melodies and the harmonies. She's always incorporating her sort of conversation into the way she sings.
Yeah, he says.
Even if she's hitting the notes.
Yeah, he says in the book that she didn't have a singer's voice; it was a performer's voice.
Right, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
Because Sondheim writes for characters, and so it's not that he doesn't enjoy cabaret. In fact, I just was at a cabaret performance of his music by Cyrilie Amé. I'm probably mispronouncing her name too, but he was there and he was visibly moved by what he was doing. So it's not, but he writes for characters and he's very exacting about his, and rightly so, about his lyrics, his notes, and I think Elaine, they were sort of locked in a kind of interesting, I'm forgetting the term it's like it's oppositional, she's tugging at him, she's always trying to be interpretive and improvisational and spontaneous and kind of no boundaries, kind of no filter, and I just think that made for a very, very interesting relationship. I think he had a great fondness for her, let's say that. Certainly their correspondence over the years, which, I'm sure he's conscious of writing for posterity, but at the same time, he clearly is affectionate, had affection for her, the most profound thing I felt he said to me about the relationship was basically that the, I'm paraphrasing, but the story of Elaine and I, it was about singing at the piano, you know, drinking at drunk at 3 a.m. And that was such a wonderful image and thought. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that many people do anymore, you know? There was something very, although obviously not, it wasn't a romance, there was a romance to it.
Yeah. Well, you've seen the production of Company. Did you see that in London?
I saw it in London. So now it's coming to Broadway with the, I actually just spoke to Patty McClellan for an article, but Patty is the only member of the cast to come to Broadway. It's a whole new cast.
So when you see her on stage playing Joanne, how much of Elaine Stritch do you see at all?
You don't. Patty McClellan has completely made over, and I understand it completely, who would want to do a kind of, I mean, that song is so closely identified with Elaine Stritch, and no one, and everyone I interviewed said, you know, and my own viewings of it confirm, no one can do that song like Elaine, absolutely no one. So mm-hmm. Patty, you know, whether it was her decision or the director's coaching or Sondheim's coaching, she went with a completely different interpretation, and you don't think of Elaine Stritch at all.
Yeah.
I thought it more of Elaine Stritch seeing Bobby as a woman. And not that her voice is anything like Elaine's, but just, you know, I felt like casting Bobby as a woman sort of fulfilled Elaine in some way. I know it you know, may sound like a stretch, but I just thought, wow, it was kind of like an intellectual, you know, the production is directed by a woman. It was kind of, and I think Elaine, as I write in the book, she struggled through her life. She never thought of being, you know, she was an actress.
Yeah.
Her craft, that was what she was. But you see in the book, you see in her life, there are times when she wanted to direct or wanted to write and wanted to take more charge of her creative process and her creative output, and she was unable to do that in her lifetime. So,
how much of the drinking do you think played a part in that say unfulfillment?
That's also an excellent question. I mean, I think that it's the other way around in a way. I think that she drank because what she was doing was not, you know, I think it, again, a feedback loop. She drank. I mean, she drank in part because, you know, there was alcoholism in her family, and it was habitual and this and that. But I think the core sort of lack of fulfillment, Elaine, was a lack of creative fulfillment, even more than a lack of romantic fulfillment. And I think the drinking, she actually, I mean, she missed out on certain parts. People, I think she was, interestingly, she drank a lot, but she was interestingly disciplined in her alcoholism. You know, she wasn't like she wasn't a gutter drunk. She wasn't another thing as I write the book, men at the time were drinking as much more. And you know, creative men and playwrights and directors and Richard Rodgers and, you know, people had alcoholism. Men had alcoholism as part of their careers practically. I don't think that it was the drinking that limited her. I think it was sexism.
Yeah.
And also just her being strange. She wasn't a conventional beauty. She wasn't conventional particularly in her self-presentation. We don't, not a cloud around her sexuality, but, you know, there's some mystery. A lot of people thought she was gay. I don't think she was gay. But, you know, I don't know. There was a lot of repression about because of her Catholicism, and, you know, whether or not, whatever her sexuality was, she certainly led an unconventional life. For someone who wasn't.
The theme of sex comes up throughout the book, and you know, the image that we have of her in At Liberty or even in 30 Rock, she has this unique appeal, and, you know, you can't take your eyes off her, if you will, and at the same time, it's interesting when we read about sex in her life, because she seemed clueless about it. I mean, how did she view
That's
sex
right.
itself?
How did she view sex?
Yeah.
I mean, she said a couple of times in intimate conversations, she had a lot of intimate conversations, but she said something like, sex is the most overrated thing. She was quite dismissive of it. Now, that said, she dated some men. Ben Gazzara, for example, wrote in his memoir about, you know, I think she did fine.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, men can be very clueless about whether their partners are enjoying the experience. We'll never know.
It
was not a priority for her. I think she cared about romance, glamour, and, you know, discipline, self-presentation, being magnetic. I think she cared much more about conversation than about, it wasn't, she didn't, she realized fairly early on she wasn't going to be the bombshell. She wasn't going to be, you know, a seductress particularly. She was going to be this immensely clever, witty, compelling, magnetic force.
Yeah.
And I think that contributed to her longevity. She didn't have to, she remained an attractive, fascinating woman till, you know, through the end.
Yeah.
And it's because she didn't, you know, she didn't, she was not, she went her own way, and she didn't have to worry about, like, losing her looks. And if anything, I mean, she got better looking, I think, because she sort of, she remained true to herself. She didn't do Botox, you know, she didn't, like, fall into the trap that so many women fall into of the industrial beauty complex.
Now, the nature of her marriage to John Bay, I mean, you write in the book that Liz Smith thought he was gay.
Yes, Liz Smith thought he was gay. A few other people did as well. I don't think he was gay. I don't think Elaine thought he was gay. I think he was drunk. I think he was, you know, a heavy drinker.
Mm.
And I think he had a lot of, he was slightly depressive. It's not systemic, I think is maybe the word. Like, you know, he seems like, I think they were a wonderful match for one another because she was so animated and he adored her and was calm and a calming force. I think that I discussed in the book, and she discusses this sort of characteristic of an actor as having no gender, which I think is very ahead of its time considering how youth culture is reevaluating the gender spectrum. I feel like Elaine had a sort of astonishingly sophisticated grasp of the fluidity of gender before that was trendy, you know? Like, not to say that it's trendy, but,
right,
you know,
yeah,
it wasn't spoken about in the same way. And, you know, she spoke of playing various Shakespearean characters and she also addressed this with about John Bay. She said, he loved men, he loved women, I love men, I love women. You know, it's like, I can be, I in order to be an actor, in order to want to be an actor, there's various kinds of actors, but one kind of actor is the actor that is so hungry for the audience's love that she is ready to be a he, if that's what the audience wants. She's ready to be a, you know, she is a they, because,
Liz Smith is someone we see throughout the book because she was seen throughout Stritch's life. I mean, when Stritch goes to Europe to act, she goes with her as an assistant.
Yes, that was wonderful, too.
Yeah.
It was fun to reconstruct. I mean, you know, it was already reconstructed in the show a bit, but when I went to the public library, to the archives where Elaine's papers are stored, to actually see the correspondence from the time was just so much fun.
Yeah. So she seemed to get a lot of things that Stritch didn't, and I'm talking about, say, judging people correctly. And she told you, I guess, that and it wasn't a compliment, that Stritch was the most naive person she ever met.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just think it was funny because Elaine Stritch projected worldliness and sophistication, and she actually, I mean, for one thing, she was very self-involved, and she was constantly preoccupied with sort of telling her own story, which was a very interesting story. I mean, her origin story and her parents and, you know, the background in Detroit and the kind of ancestral line I found fascinating. I usually don't find that fascinating in biographies. But she, you know, she comes to New York and there's this kind of, she's so focused on her own self-development that I just think she didn't care much about politics. She didn't care much about, she had wonderful sort of character resentments of other people, but they're all framed and they're all in the kind of the Elaine Stritch frame of reference, whereas Liz Smith seems less sophisticated, but she was so observant. She was a journalist, you know, and she really, she was open to connection with other people, I think, quite a bit more.
Yeah, there's a story, there's a photograph in the book of this date that she goes on with John Kennedy. And
oh, God, yes.
And then this is quite telling of her, because later on, after the assassination, she says to someone, you know, if I was in the picture, he wouldn't have been in an open car.
I know.
It says a lot, you know.
Doesn't it? I know. And that was one of the hardest things to sort of narrow down, because I found that picture early on. The lawyer showed it to me or told me about it, and actually he lent me the copy. So, you know, it was clear she'd hung out with JFK.
Yeah.
However, I mean, the Marlon Brando stuff is really real. Like, you can tell she's describing in the 50s, but after Marlon Brando becomes famous, she immediately starts telling the stories of their dating. And so you know it's real because it was contemporaneous, and obviously if it weren't true, she would have been shamed, you know, like Marlon Brando's people would have, like, told her to shut up. But no, she milked out those anecdotes forever. JFK, she doesn't start refining the details of that date until, you know, that could be because she felt more stricken by, you know, she felt stricken by his death, or she felt reverential. I don't think so. I think Elaine Stritch is the kind of person who, I don't know, though. So, but then, you know, I spoke to a couple of people who verified that it had been more than just that one night at the store club.
Yeah.
Or, you know, again, I don't think it was, I don't think they dated. I'm not sure the anecdote she tells him at Liberty or after at Liberty, really, where he invites her up. You know, that's probably embroidered, but it doesn't really matter in the end, because what is really telling is, A, her Zelig-like quality, where she pops up, you know, with all these people of the 20th century, but B, that they were, it also shows how they were in the same milieu, which was Catholic, and how sort of difficult it was to be Catholic at that time. We forget, it wasn't, you know, at the time, the idea that JFK would be president was almost as astonishing as a black person becoming president or a woman becoming president, be a Catholic or a Jew, you know. So
The thing that drew me to Stritch, watching her, say, because I grew up here in Vancouver, so seeing her on TV or online, was how a marvelous raconteur she was, a great storyteller. I mean, she was a great interviewee. So a lot of that came from these stories from her life that she told. In terms of writing this book and researching it, was she a reliable storyteller when it came to herself?
Yes, she was reliable. I mean, it was fascinating doing that because, you know, she really, I did not suffer for a lack of material, like either primary or secondary.
Uh-huh.
This is someone who was documented in gossip columns from the time that she was 13. She was popping up in Detroit society columns.
Mm.
She's the youngest of three sisters, and they're from this up-and-coming family. So that, and then she comes to New York, she immediately commandeers all the biggest gossip columnists, like Dorothy Kilgallen, who came to that end, and, you know, even Walter Winchell, like, has Leonard Lyons, and you know, all those
Earl
people.
Wilson,
so, Earl Wilson, exactly, thank you. And then she did these interviews in preparation for her show, which was one of the mother loads that I hit for this book. Was I went up to look at John Lahr's archives and up in Boston, and there were all these outtakes, I mean, rough transcripts, interviews done by Larry Grossman for the show that would become at Liberty, and I would say maybe 5% of that material, maybe less, was used, and it was like, I mean, it was like a therapy session. This guy, it's endless therapy sessions. It was like, well, for almost a year, this guy sat with her taking recordings. So, you know, that was, to me, it was such a gift, and I'm so grateful they let me use the material, because it was just tremendous. And the answer, I felt stuff like that felt really reliable to me, because she was speaking uncensored privately. You know, it wasn't stuff she was telling, it wasn't polished for a reporter. It was stuff she was saying in private sessions. The Marilyn, the Lost Tapes or whatever.
Right. I came across an interview she did with Brian Linehan in Toronto when she was promoting September, the Woody Allen movie. And she tells him that she's in the midst of writing a book. Did you find any pieces of that, say, or a manuscript even?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. This was so exciting. So, yeah, in her archives, she has, there were two times, well, actually, she did actually write a book but it was about diabetes. However, you know, she was diagnosed with diabetes, and the book is kind of, it's mostly about how to manage diabetes, but, you know, a lot of Elaine slips into it. Okay, so, but before that, starting in the 50s, she's starting to write her story, and it coincides with when she's visiting a psychoanalyst. And I feel like, you know, my father was a psychoanalyst or psychiatrist, and I felt very connected to and intrigued this idea that, you know, Elaine Stritch, who's a Catholic and grown up going to confession, you know, she would undergo this sort of bogus psychoanalysis. And it was helping her with the process of being a narrator and telling stories, which is what she did best in cocktail situations. So she starts to write a book, and she was going to call it either "Poor Little Stritch Girl" or "Shut Up and Drink Your Champagne." And she did that. Liz Smith helped her try to write it and typed for her. And, you know, they kept trying to do it. It was like Annie Maine.
Yeah.
Maine Dennis. So that never finished. That didn't get off the ground. Then the second time she tried, the third time, you know, the second book is a medical book. And then the third time she tried to do a book was because the show at Liberty is such a big hit. They say, oh, this really has to be a book.
Yeah.
And it would have been very easy for her to get a book deal. After that show. And as far as I understand it, she started to try to do it and then realized she needed a co-writer to get her thoughts down. And the simple explanation is she didn't want to pay a co-writer. Sure, she didn't want to share credit with John Lahr, who was the obvious person to co-write it.
Yeah. And then he sued her, didn't he?
Oh, my gosh, yes. So Elaine, so the show at Liberty was, it had this improvisational feeling to it that was actually incredibly scripted and refined and very rehearsed. And it was carefully scripted and refined to give the idea of spontaneity. So, but nonetheless, as John Lahr says in the book, he gave her what he considered, he knew that was going to be a party piece, as he put it, she'd use till she dropped. Like, he was fine with that. However, contractually, the contract they signed compelled her to pay him, you know, to give him royalties when she was using it, when she was using the material, and she did not do that. I firmly believe he was right to pursue, you know, and they settled that accord. So that, but yeah, he sued her because I can't remember the timing exactly. It was after, I believe it was after she came back from London, and she started performing the show in cabarets, or may have been Washington. She was performing the show even on tour, not just in cabaret settings, but in theater settings, and she wasn't paying him. She was angry. She fought it, but she wouldn't have won, and she settled it.
Yeah. It's such a fascinating life, and we've barely touched many aspects of it. But the other thing that I wanted to ask is in the Kurosawa documentary, she is seen drinking, and she refers to herself as recovered. Because she was very candid about her drinking and not drinking for a while. What did you find in terms of whether she was actually sober throughout all of that?
Yeah, that was a very touchy, you know, next to getting Stephen Sondheim to talk to me in person, that was the touchiest part of the book for me because, you know, I regard the recovery, you know, I wanted to be very respectful of people in recovery and the anonymity of people in Alcoholics Anonymous and whatever. That said, people were surprisingly forthcoming because partly because Elaine was forthcoming, partly I think because they were quite some of them were angry at her for having. So I think that Elaine Stritch was sober for long stretches of her life. I mean, I think she really committed to sobriety for significant periods. However, I don't think those periods were as long as she publicly avowed. Mm. And I think that's the source of some of the anger toward her, particularly among people in that movement. There are people who are very loyal to her and want to indicate how long she tried and her commitment and also believe in her privacy, which I completely understand. There are other people who, but for me, there were people who basically said, look, she never stopped. Like, she cut back, she had her limits, and it was like Catholicism. You sin, you go to the meeting and you confess and you're wrong, So I think the truth is sort of, I felt the book kind of, when it came out that she was drinking again at the end of her life, I remember there was a bit of a stink about that. And what the book affirmed was that, it wasn't that big a deal. She did it publicly. She did it on camera. Uh-huh. She had, again, it illustrates sort of how famous she was and how the usual trajectory of fame was, the usual parabola of fame was different for her. I mean, she was most famous at 30 Rock and at the end of her life, and people saw her drinking and remembered that she said she was sober, and there was a bit of a hullabaloo.
Yeah.
But from my reporting, it sounds like she had sober stretches, but not as long as the one she claimed in it would be. And in fact, what I understood, one of my most trusted sources basically said, look, she was sober when she was writing at Liberty, and when she started to perform it, but after it became a big hit, to manage the stress of having a hit show, then she started drinking again.
Mm.
People were protective of that. And people close to her,
It's a complicated thing, obviously, and obviously a personal thing, but it, of course, raises interest in a lot of people who, I guess, followed
That's
her
right.
life, throughout that.
That's right. And also, again, people in the pedigree for whom sobriety is an all-or-nothing thing, which I completely understand, it could feel like a betrayal of the principles of the organization. That I understand.
Yeah.
And I think I probably barely scratched the surface of that because even though, I don't understand that process completely. I mean, I tried, went to meetings and I tried to understand it, but then I'm not sober. So, but, I haven't pursued sobriety in that way. So, I don't call myself an alcoholic, so
right.
I don't really, anyway.
Yeah. As captivating as she is, she also seems tiring, and to some people, tiresome. Now written the book and lived with her as you have for the time that you've lived with her, have your feelings about her changed, say?
I had a lot of imposter syndrome when beginning this book because I'm not a dedicated, although I've written about the theater, I'm not a dedicated theater reporter and not a theater critic, and I felt Elaine has a lot of devotees. I couldn't quite understand my tremendous attraction to the subject. And early on in the process, I had a dream where Elaine Stritch appeared almost as if to reassure me. I proceeded past my doubts, and,
uh-huh.
and there were many... there were many times during the project when I grew frustrated, or I thought, I'm not getting her completely, or why am I the one to do this? I don't understand. But I persisted, and now that I've reached the end and the book has been warmly received, I feel extremely satisfied, and I feel like she's assumed a sort of proper place in my consciousness again. When you're writing a biography, just sort of live with this person all the time. Your husband lives with the person. Your children live with the person. No one can understand. It's an extraordinarily intimate relationship. Now it's like I feel she's assumed a proper position in my mind, and I also feel very glad that I've kept her alive in the public. I've contributed to keeping her alive in the public imagination because I think she was an important important figure in history who deserves it, really. You know, deserved the treatment of a book. And I'm, and you know, another book came out actually a couple months before mine by someone who spent some time with her. Shouldn't be a blogging book too, but it was somewhat, you know, it was gratifying in a way to have that happen because it reassured me that, you know, she was an important subject.
And you know that if, were she alive, she would have sent you, no, she would have probably sent you edits too, right?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure she would have. But, you know, I feel like the basic message I feel from the friends who carry her memory and, you know, the kind of mysterious psychic connection one has from the subject, is the basic feeling I have is to be a good kid. That's the phrase I feel. And, you know, it could be entirely my own fabrication, but I'm going to go with it because, you know, I feel it.
It's a tremendously entertaining book, and I mean the voice that you write in is as entertaining as she is.
You were so kind to say that. Thank you.
It's just a fun book, and I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a delight to speak with you.
The book is called Still Here: The Madcap, Nervy, Singular Life of Elaine Stritch. Farrar, Straus, and Guru is its publisher. Alexandra Jacobs joined me on the line from New York City. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.